The notion of having a broad, popular commercial journalism, as we understood for the last 100 years as sort of natural, that's no longer in existence.
Robert McChesney speaking in Denver at a media and democracy conference in 2013. A beloved professor at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign. He appeared on Democracy Now! Many times. You can go to democracynow.org for all interviews. He's died at the age of 72. That does it for our show. Happy birthday, Mike Burke.
Fresh Air Community Radio is KFAI-FM Minneapolis-St. Paul. Online and archived at KFAI.org. The community's true voice.
Miniculture is back for a brand new season.
I just think it's an interesting history and it should be told and people should know about it.
This season, we're sinking our teeth into Minnesota food history.
Long before there was Chipotle or Noodles & Company or Panera Bread or Jimmy John's, Leanne had quick service restaurants.
Exploring life and commerce along the Mississippi River.
It's kind of weird to think of water being grounding, but it is.
Meeting Minnesotans who have risked their lives to protect their fellow citizens.
He was basically a confidant, in effect, a person who the movers and shakers, where they felt comfortable.
And hearing many more stories from across the state.
Does anyone have any guesses what this is that we're paddling over right now?
I'm your host, John Gibertatios, and I can't wait for you to hear what we've got in store for you this season. Make sure you're subscribed to Miniculture wherever you get your podcasts. Season 9 premieres March 27th.
And it's here. Good afternoon and welcome to Miniculture Presents, found here on your radio dial, Monday afternoons at 1 o'clock. My name is Michael Whetstone. Delighted you've joined me today, because today on Miniculture Presents, as you just heard teased, we are thrilled to unveil the latest season of the Miniculture podcast, now in their 9th season. You can subscribe to the award-winning Miniculture podcast wherever you like to download such things. It is all over the place in all those spots that you might look for it. But you can also find it and everything else Miniculture is putting out at their SoundCloud page, soundcloud.com/miniculture, or at KFEI under the Miniculture tab. Plus, new episodes of Season 9 will be continually dropping over the next few weeks, and I'll also be airing them here on the air on Miniculture Presents a couple days later. Also today, after Episode 1 of Season 9, stick around in the second half of the show, where we'll be hearing new stories about Bob Dylan's Blood on the Tracks, cross-country ski racing, cat behavior consultants, you heard me right, and perhaps the equally unlikely troll hunting adventures. These stories are from Miniculture producers Arme Brevard, poetry, science, and wrestling host Paul Broha, and Britt Ahmed. But first, KFEI proudly presents the Miniculture podcast, Season 9, Episode 1, Ghost of the Upper Mississippi River.
Welcome to Miniculture, the podcast where we explore the people, stories, and cultural phenomena that make Minnesota, well, Minnesota. I'm your host, John Gibertatios. The section of the Mississippi River that flows between Minneapolis and St. Paul is peaceful, placid, almost like a lake. But it hasn't always been like that. Not so long ago, this section of the river was fast flowing and treacherous, and the danger of traveling upriver contributed to a fierce rivalry between Minneapolis and St. Paul. Producer Lydia Moran wanted to know more about how the river came to be this way. She started by inspecting a ghostly industrial ruin underneath the water's surface. This ruin is a clue to understanding how humans have contributed to the taming of the wild river and what the future of the river might look like.
In the Mississippi River, about a mile upstream from the Lake Street Marshall Avenue Bridge, sits an abandoned ruin. When water levels are high in spring and early summer, it's easy to miss unless you're paddling directly on top of it or avoiding its edges in a speedboat. But in the colder months, when the river is shallow, the industrial ruin emerges. 2 330-foot long concrete slabs, like sidewalks floating parallel to the riverbank. The first is just several feet from the water's edge, the second about 80 feet further out. They are dotted with a dozen bronze posts, like rust-covered thumbs. This past summer, I guided public kayak tours on the Mississippi. We took groups of paddlers downriver through the Twin Cities. I was often assigned to a route that traversed the river's gorge between Bohemian Flats Park and St. Paul's Hidden Falls Regional Park. Midway through this particular route, we stopped to float among the cement slabs and rusty bollards of the sunken ruin, our boats scraping and bumping against it.
Does anyone have any guesses what this is that we're paddling over right now?
People make guesses as they peer down into the greenish-black water. Maybe it was a dock or an anchor for barges.
Tie-up barges, yes, but what else?
Eventually, I tell them what we're looking at. This is the site of the first lock and dam on the Mississippi River.
And I talk about it as kind of like a ghost, a sort of an apparition that emerges from the water.
That's Dr. Bruce Braun, professor of geography at the University of Minnesota.
And I think of ghosts as things that haunt us from the past, things that come from the past that are still present with us and that demand a kind of reckoning.
Completed in 1907, the Meeker Island Lock and Dam helped to submerge the whitewater rapids that once existed between St. Paul and Minneapolis. It made the stretch of the river between the two cities traversable by boat, thereby increasing Minneapolis's power as a young city. But in 1912, just 5 years after the Army Corps of Engineers completed its million-dollar construction, the Corps destroyed the lock and dam and walked away. The Wild River, that cut through Minneapolis in the mid-19th century, was hardly like the river we know today. About 10,000 years ago, St. Anthony Falls was located just east of where downtown St. Paul is now, 8.5 miles from their present-day location. As water eroded the riverbed, the falls moved upriver about 4 feet per year, carving the Mississippi's only gorge. Early colonists described the river running through this gorge as one continuous rapid, marked by large boulders and a dozen small islands. They reported pulling their boats upriver for hours, using ropes tied to trees. In late season, the water was waist high at its deepest point. You could hop boulders from one side of the river to the other without getting wet. Every spring, thousands of spawning fish migrated to the gorge to wait their turn to traverse St. Anthony Falls. Fast forward to the mid-19th century, and the gorge and its harrowing rapids are feeding a fierce rivalry between the young cities of Minneapolis and St. Paul.
Like I say, Minneapolis is looking downstream and seeing steamboats come and go 1,000 times from St. Paul and only 50 times from Minneapolis.
That's Mississippi River historian John Anfinson. He says Minneapolis was desperate to suck boat traffic away from St. Paul to bring more commerce and visitors to Minneapolis. Minneapolis also wanted to claim the title of head of navigation on the Mississippi River and become the commercial bookend to New Orleans. But that just wasn't possible when riverboat captains didn't dare traverse the dangerous rapids up to Minneapolis. Of course, some boats did try to brave the rapids. In 1855, a steamboat called Fanny Harris nearly sunk in the gorge when one of its wing rudders dislodged after striking a rock, and the captains fled the wheel in fear. The boat was saved from splintering to pieces by two other pilots who stepped in and pushed it along. But word of the incident traveled and formed dark clouds of unease over the heads of many riverboat captains. In the mid-1850s, a territorial judge and businessman named Bradley Meeker proposed damming the river to improve navigation. He proposed building a dam near an island he owned along what is now East River Parkway. The project sparked controversy in the two cities, and advocates and opponents weren't always split down city lines. Shippers and civic boosters in Minneapolis were eager to make their city head of navigation and lower shipping rates, while flour millers at St. Anthony Falls were wary of the competition the dam might bring. In St. Paul, some believed the dam would bring hydropower to their city, while others feared losing the title of head of navigation. But then, the Civil War erupted. The country fell into an economic depression, and the lock and dam project went on hold. 4 months before the war ended, State Senator John Pillsbury decided to take over construction of a lock and dam at Meeker Island himself. He helped convince the Minnesota legislature to ask Congress for a 200,000-acre land grant of Minnesota forest. The money from the timber harvested on the land would fund the construction. Congress obliged, but gave the land to the state of Minnesota to decide on the builder instead. But 2 decades of political jousting later, a builder still hadn't been chosen. In January of that year, Minneapolis Mayor Eugene Wilson asserted, quote, "Every dollar's worth of property in the city would increase 20% the minute the dam was completed." In an interview with the Minneapolis Tribune, he complained that without a passable river, commercial interests in Minneapolis would be entirely at the mercy of the railroad barons. By the 1890s, groups in Minneapolis were hounding the federal government to build a lock and dam, and the state of Minnesota had not chosen a builder, but was refusing to return the land grant. Tired of playing referee to regional infighting, Congress authorized funding to the Army Corps of Engineers to build a lock and dam at Meeker Island in 1894. They also authorized funding for a second dam, confusingly called Lock and Dam No. 1, which is still in operation along present-day Ford Parkway. The two low dams would finally make Minneapolis the head of navigation on the Mississippi River, but they were built at a height incapable of producing the hydroelectric power some business leaders in Minneapolis were hell-bent on keeping from St. Paul. Only one dam would have been enough to improve navigation, but the Corps moved forward with both. Much of the reason for this is still shrouded in mystery. Years later, Army Corps District Engineer Major Francis Schunk hinted at the stubborn rivalry between St. Paul and Minneapolis and the murky backroom politics that led to the superfluous lock and dam. He wrote, "There is the city of St. Paul and there is the city of Minneapolis. Enough said. There are two locks." Over 50 years after businessman Bradley Meeker proposed building a lock and dam near his land, construction finally began. By this point, Meeker himself had been dead for more than 3 decades, and the river was well on its way to becoming the highly engineered body of water we know today. But Bruce Braun at the University of Minnesota points out that when Meeker first proposed damming the Wild River, he was doing so at a time when the Mississippi's life as an industrial highway was not written in stone.
In 1852, that was just 1 year after the treaty was signed with the Dakota that, in a sense, opened the west side of the river to settlement. And it was a full decade before the Dakota Uprising of 1862. And so I asked myself, you know, what made it possible that someone like Meeker was, and others, were imagining the river in a very different way, a very new way, at the same time as that river and surrounding areas are still very much part of Dakota life worlds. So it's this almost willful erasure, this way in which a different kind of world, a different way of relating to the river is being completely ignored and, in a sense, imagined to be passing away.
The truth is, Meeker wasn't solely interested in helping Minneapolis claim dominance over St. Paul. To some, Meeker and his associates' original proposal to build the lock and dam was a scheme to defraud the government and a land grab. As Minneapolis businessman Henry Titus Wells put it in his memoirs, the original Meeker Dam proposal was first and foremost, quote, the attempt of a few selfish plunderers to seize upon 200,000 acres of the best pine lands of the state and hold them for speculation. Which is to say, the remaking of the Mississippi River Gorge into the Placid Highway, the one that threaded the agricultural landscapes of the upper Midwest with faraway markets, is inextricably bound with the land theft and genocide of indigenous people throughout Minnesota.
And so, what is the reckoning that the Meeker Dam requires of us today? What does it mean to, like, reflect on this dam, its history, its provenance, and think about the kind of violent erasures that were possible at that moment, such that the river could be imagined as something that we take for granted now, that it simply is that river, it is that settler river.
In spring of 1907, the first steamboat passed through the newly completed Meeker Island Lock and Dam. In total, the Corps spent over $1 million, the equivalent of $37 million today, constructing the Meeker Dam and Lock and Dam No. 1.
So it's amazing to think that the Corps of Engineers builds this lock and dam, and then only 3 years later, Congress authorizes abandoning it.
That's right. In 1910, Congress directed the Corps to destroy Meeker Island Lock and Dam just 3 years after it was completed.
What would happen today if the Corps of Engineers built a big lock and dam and said, oh, we're going to get rid of that now 3 years later? It'd be all over the news. It would be, you know, touted as a real debacle.
At the turn of the 20th century, long-distance electrical transmission became possible for the first time, allowing dams to transmit their hydropower further away from rivers. At the same time, the frontier was gone. Westward expansion had reached its limit, and Americans began to realize that natural resources were finite, sparking the conservation movement. President Teddy Roosevelt advocated that rivers should have multiple uses beyond navigation, one of those uses being the generation of electricity.
And so those events all happen about the time that the Meeker Island Lock and Dam is authorized and being built. So it just gets bypassed by the evolution of hydroelectricity in America. And people start realizing, wow, we missed a major opportunity in the Twin Cities for hydroelectric power.
Ironically, boosters in Minneapolis and St. Paul set aside their differences to lobby Congress for the construction of one high dam to replace the two low ones. In 1910, Congress directed the Corps to raise Lock and Dam No. 1 from 13.3 feet to over 30 feet, a height that was capable of producing hydropower. In the process, the brand new Meeker Dam was submerged, where it remains today. The Minneapolis Tribune did not report a public outcry at the project's restructuring. In a 1911 article under the headline, Big Lake Created, the paper heralded the high dam's creation of a, quote, lake which in area will be about as large as Lake Calhoun and Lake of the Isles together, capable of backdropping picturesque boating outings and the University of Minnesota's row team. The plumbing of the gorge also sparked real estate ads touting new lakefront-esque property along the soon-to-be serene waterway. But the increase in riverfront property value proved to be a mirage when floating islands of sewage backed up behind the new high dam. The slowly flowing river became a stinking, typhoid-ridden pool of water until about 1933, when the city built its first wastewater treatment plant. By 1963, two more dams had been constructed upriver at Lower and Upper St. Anthony Falls to form a stairway of water that carried barges up to the ports of North Minneapolis. But Minneapolis's dreams of commercial navigation on the river were ultimately short-lived. By 2000, only two barges a day came through the upper Mississippi locks, partly because agricultural transport was moved to the Minnesota River. In 2014, Congress directed the closing of Upper St. Anthony Falls Lock and Dam. The Corps of Engineers is currently in the midst of another study to determine if it is worth the cost to continue maintaining the two that remain open, only now for the occasional fishing boat, river cruise, or kayak tour group. One possible option they are researching is removing those two dams altogether and returning the river to its wildness.
So I got interested in this project many years ago, really just as a community member.
That's Dr. Rupali Fadke, professor of environmental studies at McAllister College. She became aware of the core study after attending a public hearing about it with some of her students.
We were just listening to how the Corps was trying to defend its project and its process, and I saw the level of interest and animosity that was coming from the public, and I remember thinking, this is fascinating what's going on here in my backyard, and it's this topic that I've studied all over the world, and to see it sort of playing out in my own community. There's not a lot of examples of dam removal in an urban corridor like this, so it's pretty precedent-setting.
Dr. Fadke received funding from the National Science Foundation to advise the Corps on how to engage public opinion on the future of Lock and Dam No. 1 and Lower St. Anthony Falls Lock and Dam.
How do we think about a future river without the locks and dams? It's really, really difficult if it's not in our living memory. And so engaging communities in thinking about what is their relationship to the river now, what do they want the future river to be and to do and for whom? It's a really challenging question.
Through surveys, interviews, and focus groups, Dr. Fadke and her team were able to engage over 400 people. They found that those in favor believed that removing the dams would improve access to the river, which could encourage new forms of recreation and tourism. But overwhelmingly, those in favor understood the main benefit to be improving the river's ecosystem. From a 1963 study, we know that over 123 species of fish were once in the gorge. Studies that took place between 1980 and 2022 found 27 species in total, and some of those were in numbers less than five. If fish were able to freely migrate without the dams, they could restore their native habitat and increase the river's resilience against invasive species such as Asian carp.
But I do always caution people that rivers are living things and you can't just turn back the clock and every minute the river is something different. There will be a pretty impressive degree of social and geoengineering that it will take to restore the river. We will be building channels. We will be building islands. We will be channelizing it in ways that maybe represent the historical flows, but it's not going to return to its, you know, pre-1900s look and feel.
Dr. Braun at the University of Minnesota agrees.
There's no original river to recover. That's gone. And so now it's a question of, you know, whose futures are embodied in the river that we invent.
Dr. Fadke's team also heard from people who were opposed to the idea of dam removal. Some were concerned with the level of toxic sediment that has been built up behind the dams and would have to be accounted for if they were removed. Others were worried about the potential financial costs of dam removal to the public. And as the planet continues to warm, bringing unpredictable precipitation events, it may be in our best interest to have control over the river's water levels. But realistically, the prospect of dam removal is a distant one. The study that the Corps is currently undertaking won't be available for public comment for at least another year. And after that, there will likely be a long back and forth about whether the Corps sells the infrastructure and to whom, and if those parties even have the right or ability to remove the locks and dams. That may take up to 10 years. But Dr. Fadke wants the public to stay engaged throughout the process. As part of their public engagement work, Dr. Fadke's team set up postcard writing stations at locations across the Twin Cities. They asked people to answer the question, what is your wish for the river?
I would love to walk along the banks and pick berries. Or, you know, can the river help me pass my SAT test? Or, you know, so there's just this wide and lovely and, again, like, curious selection of wishes that people had. I want the fish to be able to thrive. I want the water to be clean. I want to be able to swim in the river. There were also postcards that said, it's really important to me that the river be, you know, let's say, quote unquote, returned to Native communities, or that Native communities, tribal communities, will steward what happens next to the river. When I think about what a healthy river is. It's one that's in relationship with the people that live around it. We know that climate anxiety is a huge issue. What would it mean to be able to access the river and have those sort of moments of wild nature? It might afford a really different kind of resilience.
Last summer, after stopping at Meeker Dam ruins, we head downriver to descend 30 feet in Lochan Dam number 1.
Doors are closing.
This dam still generates hydroelectricity. It once powered a Ford manufacturing plant. Now, a Canadian energy corporation owns the site and sells the relatively small amount of power it generates back to the grid. After the doors open, we wind past the mouth of Minnehaha Creek.
Yep. And we're gonna stay to the right when we get out. Yep.
Now that we're out of the gorge, the headwind has subsided and the current moves a bit quicker, pulling us along. In the distance, the river is bending towards a journey that is still yet ahead. For KFAI, I'm Lydia Moran.
This episode was written and produced by Lydia Moran. Kaylin Keir provided audio mixing support. Special thanks to Paddle Bridge Kayak Tours. Mini Culture is a production of KFAI Fresh Air Community Radio in Minneapolis, Minnesota. Support for Mini Culture is provided by the Minnesota Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund. This podcast is edited and executive produced by Julie Sinsula. More episodes are coming soon, so make sure you're subscribed to Mini Culture wherever you get your podcasts. I'm your host, John Gibertatios. Thanks for listening.
You are listening to Mini Culture Presents here on KFAI. My name is Michael Whetstone, and that was episode 1 of season 9, Ghost of the Upper Mississippi River. New episodes of season 9 will be continually dropping over the next few weeks for about a month or so, and I will also be airing them here on Mini Culture Presents a few days later after they drop. So be sure to tune in next week for episode 2, The Long Dark Shadow of Minnesota's Eugenic Sterilization Program, from producer Matthew Schneeman. Or if you subscribe to the Mini Culture Podcast, wherever you dig listening to those sorts of things, you'll probably get to hear it a few days early. It's going to be dropping on April 3rd. There are also 8 more great seasons for you to enjoy and catch up on. You can stay on top of everything these talented producers are doing at Mini Culture's SoundCloud page, soundcloud.com. You'll find buckets of terrific arts, history, and culture stories about our great state there on the SoundCloud page. And you can easily share them and send them to your friends and family from there. I just shared the story about the invention of bag handles to my own father. And if you would like to help keep these very vital and hyper-local Minnesota-centric stories on the air, consider making a pledge to Mini Culture's radio home, KFEI, which relies on your financial support. This is real community, truly people-powered public radio. Please make a difference and a donation today at KFEI.org. Thank you. You are listening to Fresh Air Community Radio, KFEI 90.3 FM in Minneapolis and St. Paul, Radio Without Boundaries. Support for this program comes from KFEI listener members, just like you, and the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Support for Mini Culture is made possible by a grant from the Minnesota Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund. Stick around after the break. We'll be hearing new Mini Culture stories about Bob Dylan's Blood on the Tracks, cross-country ski racing, kitty cat behavioral consultants. And if that wasn't unbelievable enough, our final story is about troll hunting. These stories come to us from Mini Culture producers Arme Rivard, poetry, science, and wrestling host Paul Broha, and Britt Ahmet. Stay with us.
KFAI is supported by Mutual Management Company. Mutual Management Company provides tailor-quality housing services. Areas of expertise include managing affordable housing with a personalized focus on strengthening the community. Mutual Management serves an assorted portfolio of renters and owners of scattered site and single site residential and commercial developments designed to preserve and protect real people with a real property in the Twin Cities. Find out more by calling 612-333-9164 and online at mutualmanagementcompany.com.
See the light when the Blind Boys of Alabama take the stage at the Dakota Thursday, April 3rd. From their Recording Academy Lifetime Achievement Award to their 6 Grammys to their induction into the Gospel Music Hall of Fame, the Blind Boys of Alabama are living legends in every sense of the word. Touring with their latest release, Echoes of the South, every song reverberates with their signature blend of gospel, soul, country, and rock into the transcendent songs of faith and hope. Tickets for the Blind Boys of Alabama can be found at the Dakota website. Visit DakotaCooks.com for more details.
Fellas, I said that's it.
You are listening to Miniculture on KFAI. This year, 2025, marks the 50th anniversary of Bob Dylan's Blood on the Tracks. The 1975 album has strong Minnesota connections. Not only was half of it re-recorded at the last minute at the local Sound 80 studio, but Dylan also hired local musicians to rework 5 songs on the album that he hoped would be his commercial comeback. KFAI producer Britt Ahmed tells the story of these Minneapolis recordings.
Kevin Odegaard wanted to watch TV. It was December 1974, and he was holed up with his favorite Thursday night crime drama, Kojak. But then the phone started ringing.
I just let it ring, because I thought for sure it was a crew call.
He was a brakeman for the Chicago Northwestern Railroad. He could use the shift, but no way was he giving up his sofa to freeze his butt on the rails.
Finally, when the show ended, and Kojak said, "Who loves you, baby?" I picked up. It was David Zimmerman.
Odegaard's other life was as a Minneapolis musician, and Zimmerman was his manager. But more importantly, for this story, David Zimmerman was Bob Dylan's younger brother.
He wanted a small-bodied Martin guitar. He was asking for a gut string model from the 30s. Oh, that's a tall order.
Being a musician, Odegaard knew his way around the local music shops. He knew just the dealer to call. And he knew just who the Martin was for.
I started to understand that Bob was standing behind him, breathing down his neck, because he wanted this guitar.
Odegaard called the dealer, who happened to have almost the exact guitar on consignment. But what was Dylan doing in Minnesota? In 1961, Dylan had hitched a ride out of Minnesota to find fame and fortune as a New York folkie and international rock star. So the fact that he had returned
started this amazing handful of days in Minneapolis at Sound 80.
Paul Metza is the co-author of Blood in the Tracks, the Minnesota musicians behind Dylan's masterpiece. The book details the re-recording of 5 tracks on an album Dylan had promised for Christmas 1974, but delayed because he didn't like the recordings he'd made a few months before in New York with top-notch session musicians. It had been nearly a decade since anything Bob Dylan put out had felt relevant. And that was beginning to bother the guy who'd once been hailed as the voice of the 1960s generation.
Dylan was looking to make a commercial comeback.
Rick Shevchik is Metz's co-author.
In the mid-60s, it had gotten too much for him, and he intentionally withdrew, but he was starting to sort of creep back into public consciousness. He was really searching for where he wanted to be and who he wanted to be at that stage. And he wrote a batch of songs that were among the best that he'd ever written.
Dylan had written these songs on his Martin guitar, but it was stolen. That's why his brother called Odegaard during Kojak, and why the next night, the guitarist and sometime railroad brakeman found himself at Sound 80, one of Minneapolis's preeminent recording studios, with the replacement Martin and Bob Dylan.
Strangely enough, nobody was nervous. There were a couple of double takes.
Also in attendance were a handful of local musicians,
They weren't just garage band musicians or pickup musicians. These were the best musicians in Minnesota.
These pros, Metza says, got right to work, banging out a new version of a song called Idiot Wind. The New York version felt laid back. This one got right in your face with an edge that cut. Dylan liked it so much, he had them do another song and then called them back on Monday to do three more. Odegaard hadn't been brought in to play. He was there because of the Martin, so he sat out the first session. But the second night, he got his chance.
Let's just, yeah.
Dylan was in a relaxed mood.
He was with his homeboys in Minneapolis. He wasn't with a bunch of studio hotshots with New York City.
He played through a song in the key of G. Then Odegaard and the band played through it.
Okay. But afterward, it was kind of dead air. And Bob is right there in front of me. And he said, so what'd you think? And I was too relaxed, so I told him the truth. I said, it's passable. It's fine the way it is, but he said, but what?
Odegaard suggested moving the key to A, to Bob Dylan, the icon, the future Nobel laureate. Dylan studied the floor for a second, then
looked up and said, yeah, okay, yeah, let's give it a try.
The engineer hit record, and that live take of Tangled Up in Blue, along with the other Minnesota re-recordings, made it on Bob Dylan's January 1975 release, Blood on the Tracks, the album that succeeded in putting him back on top. Yet ever since that time, critics and fans have been divided. Were the New York or Minnesota recordings better? In 2018, Dylan released all the versions on More Blood, More Tracks, but that didn't end the debate. Co-authors Rick Shefchik and Paul Metza say one answer may rest in the original album's enduring popularity.
I have to be honest that I just don't think Blood on the Tracks would have been anywhere near as successful if they had stuck to just the New York recordings. I think that the five re-recordings in Minneapolis is what made it a great album.
It's not only one of Dylan's greatest records, it's one of the greatest rock and roll records of all time.
As for Kevin Odegaard, who just wanted to stay and watch Kojak, those 2 days forever attached his name to that of Bob Dylan, which is okay for this guitarist.
People say this and that about Bob, but I love Bob. I've been happy to live in his shadow for 50 years.
For KFAI, this is Britt Ahmet.
You've been listening to Miniculture on KFAI. Support for Miniculture on KFAI is provided by the Minnesota Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund. For more stories like this, check out the Miniculture tab on the KFAI website or go to kfai.org/minneculture. Last July, a stray cat showed up at producer Britt Ahmet's house. Britt took him in and named him Honey, but Honey was anything but sweet with her other two cats. She didn't want to rehome him, so she decided to call Joey Lisvardi, a Twin Cities-based cat behavior consultant who runs Class Act Cats. With Joey's help, Britt hopes this cat tale has a happy ending. Here's Britt with more.
It started off innocently enough.
Are you hungry?
Late July, this cat shows up, all skin and bones. I mean, so scrawny, his ears looked like they belonged to a cat three times his size. But he kept showing up. So I gave him a name.
Honey, here's your food.
Honey for the honey-colored spots and tail on this otherwise white kitty. At first, he wouldn't let me near him. But eventually, he graduated to visiting inside the house, to playing with me, to letting me pet him. Finally, in December, I took the plunge. I brought him to the vet for neutering, where I was told Honey had won the award for most parasites in a single cat at their office. The vet seemed pleased with this. But no wonder he'd been so shabby and skinny looking.
There you go.
I should probably back up and tell you something. I already had two cats when Honey showed up, Timber and Finn. They tolerated this new cat, even if they liked to boss him around a little. There were some snarls, some swats, pretty tame stuff. But oh boy, that was about to change. A now healthy and happily domestic Honey had turned into a bully. He looked like that nerd in school after a summer of hitting the weight room and pounding protein shakes. And he'd gotten an attitude, too. I was spending all day keeping Honey from pouncing and ripping the other two to shreds. I'm thinking, oh, God, was I going to have to rehome this guy? I didn't want to, but... So I contacted Joey Lasvardi.
I run Class Act Cats, where I help people who have cat behavior problems, ranging from aggression towards humans to aggression between cats. I see a lot of aggression and litter box issues. And I also help people with training because, yes, cats can be trained. Contrary to the myth out there that they're not trainable, they're actually very trainable.
Lasvardi is a Twin Cities-based certified cat behavior consultant. He got into the field because, at one time, he too had an aggression problem with his cat, Zoloft.
I was working a job that I'd leave the house before the sun would rise, and I'd come home after the sun would set, and I wouldn't see the sun. And I would feed Zoloft, and I would go to sleep, and I didn't feel like doing much, and I was super burnt out. I wasn't playing with him. I wasn't paying attention to him, and... He started developing these weird episodes. He would kind of follow me around, and he would curl his tail in, and then he would make this very, very just distressed-sounding noise, and he would bite me. I started becoming scared because I was like, I don't know what to do.
He came to realize that Zoloft was acting out of frustration. There was a reason for his behavior. And Lasvardi figured out he had to change his behavior, too, if he was going to help his cat. This also led him down the line to decide to get trained and certified as a cat behavior consultant. At our first session, I unloaded on him.
This cat that I'm so impressed with, he's getting so healthy. But the problem is that he will go after the other cats like a heat-seeking missile.
Mm-hmm.
They'll turn their back, and he's like a street brawler. I mean, I've actually seen fur fly.
A lot of behavior concerns are going to come down to fear or anxiety or stress, which are variations of similar emotions. But the cat is feeling threatened that these other cats are going to harm them in some way, or they're going to steal their food, or they're going to take away something from them, or that they might hurt them. And
very real.
Yeah. And it the other part of it, too, is it sounds like in your case, socialization, where this new cat may not have had a lot of experience with other cats or may have had really bad experiences with other cats, which can make it very, very challenging to get them to be like, hey, this other cat is not a threat.
He gave me homework, and there were no spray bottles involved, which is usually the advice you get on the internet. For the first couple weeks, I pretty much had to keep the dudes in separate parts of the house.
There's Timber.
But in the long term, that wasn't going to work.
What do you think of having Honey in the house?
So mostly I just let them go where they wanted to. But I had to pay attention and get there before Honey started to pounce. Taking Lasvardi's advice, I would hold up a blanket or a pillow between Honey and what other cat he was aggressing against. And then calmly, I would redirect Honey's energy into something else. And actually, it worked. But let me just say right here, it took a lot of time and effort, and it still does. But only a month in my follow-up session with Joey Lasvardi, I was able to report that Honey had not beaten the fluff out of Timber or Finn in almost 2 weeks.
Oh, Honey. I hear you're doing better, Honey.
We're not perfect yet.
There's Fifi McGee. There's Honey.
But we're working on it.
No fighting, huh? Nope.
This is Brenomet for KFAI.
You are listening to Miniculture on KFAI. For many Minnesota athletes, it's all about the distance. From runners who take on the Twin Cities or Duluth Marathons, to cross-country skiers who traverse 50 kilometers for the American Birkebeiner in Wisconsin. There's something special about a long-distance race and the communities that these races attract. Just a few weeks ago, a 100-kilometer ski race was added to the Midwest's long list of long-distance races. The Ski North Ultra Marathon, which happened in early March, is a 62-mile cross-country ski course. KFAI's Paul Broha set off with a crew of assistant producers to watch the first Ski North Ultra and to meet some of the people who spent their whole day skiing through the woods in northern Minnesota.
How are you guys feeling?
Excited for a day in the woods.
Yeah, it should be great. Yeah, it should be fun, you know?
There's some moose tracks out there.
Really?
We saw moose tracks around the 40K mark.
Oh, here we go! It's a Saturday morning, early March, on Minnesota's north shore of Lake Superior. 71 skiers just left the starting area near some campsites at Cascade River State Park. The snow is actually too thin in this area to mechanically groom the trails. It's been thawing and freezing. It's crusty. No one seems to mind.
How do you feel?
Oh, really good.
I'm doing great, actually.
Pure joy.
Just a few days before this 100-kilometer Ski North Ultra Marathon, race director Allie Ricken wasn't quite sure if the full course would be skiable or if the race would even actually happen. A late-season dump of snow in the Twin Cities completely missed the North Shore, but the little snow there was at Cascade River just barely held out on the rocky trails. And Allie got friends and family to patch up some of the dicey parts with shovels and pickaxes.
So you're saying there is some snow out there?
Yep. It is starting to melt, though.
You think it'll stay enough for tomorrow's race?
Hopefully.
That's my sweetheart, Ingrid, speaking with Allie's daughter, Rosemary, while her dad was chipping ice off some wooden steps. All of my kids are here, too. Ingrid's skiing in the race, and Allie is a good friend of ours. She talked to me earlier about some of the adventurous aspects of this course.
When I was originally planning this, I got a good chuckle because it says, you know, ski trail across the waterfall bridge. But then I went there. There's stairs. So that's a walk across. People will have to take their skis off unless they really want to go for it.
Bring your stair skis.
That would wreck your skis.
The night before the race, Allie went over the maps with some of her volunteers.
If you go a little bit further straight, you'll run into a loop that it's not groomed, but it hopefully looks like a skiable situation.
Saturday morning started at about 14 degrees, which made for some great beardicles on the folks with facial hair and frozen eyelashes all around. I caught up with the pack about 10 kilometers in at the first rest stop.
How's the traffic coming?
It's pretty good, yeah. I think by this point it's a little more relaxed.
It started to snow and felt like a Christmas card as skiers disappeared up the narrow trail with just one set of ski tracks. This race was set up to finish mostly in the daylight. That's a little less than 12 hours at this time of the year. But over 100 kilometers, or 62 miles, that can mean the fastest ones will come in 3 or 4 hours before the ones at the end. People started to stretch out at the third rest stop. One person cheerfully munched on a cardamom bun while some medics patched up her bloody knee. She said she crashed into a rotten log. The next bit of excitement on the trail was back at the fabled footbridge, some 30 feet above the rocks and ice of the Cascade River.
We're going to try to catch up with some skiers making their way across the bridge. Liam, take it from here.
All right, Raven.
That's my son, Raven, talking with his friend, Liam.
Hey, I'm Liam here with KVI, just wondering how you're feeling about the race.
All right, how about you? Having fun out?
Yeah. How are you feeling?
This sucks, Mike. How's it going?
How's it
feeling good? Oh, yeah.
33K.
How's the snow looking?
The snow, it snowed! And people were delighted.
That last one there was Ingrid, our skiing reporter. This race also had 25-kilometer and 50-kilometer events. And by the middle of the day, those racers started intermingling on the trails with the 100-kilometer skiers. Raven and Liam and my other son, Tamarack, migrated up the hill to a little clearing in the woods where the shorter races started to finish on a sunny downhill that looked a bit like a mountain bike trail. They were lured into announcing results.
Go, Molly!
Molly-os.
Louder, louder.
Let's go, Molly.
Here comes Molly.
124.
Let's go get an interview. Oh, he's gone.
Okay, we are here at the finish line. You know, we got some spectators gathered around. It's been a little bit slow. Usually it's been around 10 minutes between people that are finishing the race.
Liam caught up with the winner of the 50-kilometer race, Kenneth Rip.
It seemed like it was going to start as like a real adventure race because of this section, this last section, and then have them take your skis off and run over the ice. That was really exciting.
Yeah.
And then once we got on the track and then the snow started to come down, it was gorgeous. And just skiing by, just serene out there.
For the other racers, temperatures started climbing and it made the fresh layer of snow start to stick to the bottom of lots of skis. This was a classic-only race, not a skate-skiing race, which means you ski in a running motion in parallel tracks, theoretically. It's March in Minnesota, so you ski on whatever surface you can find. About 2:30 in the now sunny afternoon, race director Allie Ricken was at the last major intersection where the racers either turned left to finish or went straight to do another 20-kilometer section.
I was just reading all the people that are, like, still unaccounted for.
Oh, how many are you missing?
Oh, no, I'm on the radio. Oh, a handful, but
I'm sure they'll turn up.
They'll turn up. They'll turn up. And if not, we'll go find them. Oh, here comes the skier. All right, Louis!
Straight ahead. You guys, straight ahead.
Where's the finish?
That way.
We reckoned our skiing reporter, Ingrid, should be coming up on about 80 kilometers at this point. I decided to ski up the hill to see if I could find her. I saw the skier with the bloody knee looking strong at about 79 kilometers.
It really does feel like we're in the mountains here, the way the sun hits the snow and the pine trees.
Woo! All right. Yay! Final lap or one more?
No, we're done, man. All right. Check
this out. So the weather, the sunlight, the snow, the feeling in the air. I said this should be a nice closing touch to the day, but some people still have to do this last 20-kilometer loop one more time, including this person.
Oh, no.
Oh, no?
You have to stay with me.
That reporter is faster than this one. Well, Ingrid did finish a couple hours later, about 30 minutes after dark, and just before a snowmobile sweeper came through. She was number 52 out of the 52 who finished, ages 16 through 63. The finish line scene was dark, maybe 10 people standing in the forest with headlamps, smiling, and expressing other emotions.
Oh my gosh, I feel like that should have been like easier than it was or something. Like my everything, I'm not going to be able to walk tomorrow, you guys.
Well, you did just ski 62 miles. With reporting assistance from Raven Broha, Liam McNiff, Tamarack Broha, and Ingrid Remack, for KFAI, I'm Paul Broha, Cascade River State Park, Minnesota.
You are listening to Mini Culture on KFAI. Spring of 2024, the city of Detroit Lakes, Minnesota, partnered with artist Thomas Dambo to create a series of troll sculptures out of recycled materials. The trolls, each with their own unique persona, are spread out across Detroit Lakes, inviting visitors and residents to search for them. KFAI producer Armay Rivard spoke with Detroit Lakes residents who share tips on where to find these trolls.
When I was a kid, my introduction to a troll was in the story From the Three Billy Goats Gruff. My children were introduced to three gruesome trolls in the Hobbit movie and the humongous troll in the Harry Potter series. All of these trolls were scary and mean. Now then, my grandkids will be introduced to some fun and friendly trolls, thanks to Danish artist Thomas Dambo, who worked with the community of Detroit Lakes, Minnesota, and Project 412, which is a community-led nonprofit who sponsored the trolls and coordinated the 300 volunteers in May of 2024. The project consists of 9 sculptures, of which 5 are whimsical giant trolls, an immense golden rabbit, 3 portals, and 500 birdhouses. all constructed using recycled materials such as pallet wood, plastic containers, and loads of TLC. This art installation has a unique twist. The sculptures are located in different areas in and around Detroit Lakes, and visitors will have to decode riddles to find the trolls. How? By playing the trail game. There is a simple rule to follow. Don't disclose the location of the trolls. The artist wants all visitors to enjoy their troll hunting experience. Now then, I caught up with some local troll hunters to see how it works.
Hi, my name is Karen. The first one we found was really easy to find. Her name is Alexa, and she is nestled in the city park.
Like, we're supposed to keep a secret. No, that's right. Okay.
This is the only clue we're going to give you where the trolls are, because you will head to Alexa, and you're going to find a book with riddles in it of where to find the next troll.
Karen Johnson of Brainerd, Minnesota, just shared where your journey begins, Detroit Lake City Park, where Alexis Elixir commands center stage with her spellbook of riddles. Now then, you need to decipher those riddles to find the location of the other trolls to go a troll hunting.
Hi everyone, I'm Diana. I did it a little differently. I went in cold. I wasn't listening to instructions. We kind of winged it. It was just a mystery to everybody in the area. We just kind of learned from word of mouth.
Now, troll hunters don't need to rely on the grapevine like Diana Snowgrove did. There's a variety of ways to see the trolls and a variety of trolls to meet, including Alexa, Ronnie Funny Face, Barefoot Frida, Jacob Everear, and Longleaf.
I'm very fortunate that we have this in our area. There are portals that you can find as well, ones at Roberts Alley, Holmes Theater, Becker County Museum, and Perm City Hall at Turtle Park.
According to the storyline, the portals are extensions of Alexis' arms, and her magical reach crosses into Fargo, North Dakota.
I have a granddaughter that's 9 that loves rabbits. On the last trip we made, our goal was to find the golden rabbit. And you're walking along and you cannot see these trolls. There's no evidence of where they are. It was a little harder to find than one would imagine. Like the name implies, it is gold, bright yellow, and it's made out of recycled plastic.
Now that I have found the secret location of these happy trolls, I can hardly wait to introduce them to my grandkids. I know they're going to love the adventure.
You've been listening to Mini Culture on KFAI. Support for Mini Culture on KFAI is provided by the Minnesota Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund. For more stories like this, check out the Mini Culture tab on the KFAI website at kfai.org/MINNECULTURE.
You have been tuned into Mini Culture Presents here on KFEI. Earlier in today's program, we unveiled episode 1 of the Mini Culture podcast, now in their 9th season. If you enjoyed this, I've got good news. Come back next week for more episodes as we continue to broadcast Mini Culture season 9. And if you can't wait for next week, check it out wherever you dig listening to your podcasts. It is in all the usual outlets. Episode 2 lands on April 3rd. You can also find it at kfei.org under the Mini Culture tab. This is Fresh Air Community Radio, KFEI 90.3 FM in the Twin Cities. Support for this program comes from KFEI listener members and the Corporation for Public Broadcast. Support for Mini Culture is made possible by a grant from the Minnesota Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund. Have a beautiful day, and thanks again for tuning in. Coming up next, Upside Down.